874,000 employees are estimated to take sick absence each year as a result of conflict, at an estimated cost to the organisation of $2.2 billion. GitNux.org is the where these statistics come from. And then adding to this, in the UK, an average of 485,800 employees resign each year as a result of work conflicts. So even if some of those ones that are resigning were also off sick first, you're still talking about a million employees probably a year who are struggling with conflict and because the conversations aren't being had.
Welcome to the Hands On Business podcast. Where else are you going to come to get tips, tricks and advice on growing your business? As you know, what people tend to love about this podcast is that it is a place where you can hear real business leaders discussing systems, methodologies and strategies that they have used to help them catapult growth in their business. So I'm your podcast host, Hakeem Adebiyi, and I've grown several small businesses to multi-million pound enterprises and noticed that there wasn't really a place that focused on where I was, i.e. growing a small business. All of the content that seemed to be out there was about big business and often just a lot of theory and no practical implementable advice, which is exactly why I set up this podcast. So take a listen, enjoy, and start implementing the strategies that you hear on the podcast. Happy listening. So, difficult conversations at work. I think we've all had the necessity to have them at some time or another, have we not? The question is, when you need to have one, do you ignore it and hope it all goes away? Or do you go in like a bull in a china shop and sort it out? So the real question is, if there's a right way to have difficult conversation, and what's the impact of not approaching it correctly, or potentially worse, ignoring the situation or the person altogether? Now, every action has a reaction. So there will be an impact on your business when a difficult conversation needs to be had. Therefore, I think it's a topic worthy of further investigation, and I invite my next guest, Nicola Richardson, to the show to discuss this topic. Now, Nicola, with over 33 years of hands-on experience in business leadership, brings lots of practical knowledge and expertise to the table. She's dedicated years to mentoring managers in both large and small businesses, helping them hold those difficult conversations that we're going to talk about. Now, Nicola belongs to the Chartered Management Institute, which ensures, obviously, that she stays updated on the latest trends and best practices in management, leadership, and, most importantly, difficult conversations. So I'm going to be picking Nicola's brain this morning on avoiding difficult conversations is harming your business. Welcome, Nicola. Glad you could join us.
Really pleased to be here. And thank you so much for the invite. I'm really looking forward to sharing some insights and having a decent conversation about difficult conversations, because I think it's a really important subject. And I remember back from my corporate days that on the people survey, every year there was a high percentage of employees who complained that conversations weren't happening with people with poor behaviours and poor performance. So there's really, it causes massive disruption at times.
No, it certainly doesn't. And you just mentioned there about your corporate life. So just talk us a bit around your background in terms of going through the corporate, and just a quick intro to how you now come to be working in leadership and, you know, a lot around how to have those difficult conversations.
So, 2014, my father was seriously ill in hospital. I'd been in for 3 weeks. Now, my journey to work was 2 hours each way. So I was working as operations lead, and it was very fast paced, very stressful. Add on to the mix my dad not being well, and I actually thought he hadn't got much longer left. And I was really struggling to cope, but was keeping going. It was like work was my lifeline, kept me just focused. And but I had a manager who had favourites, who would dip in and out of what you were doing if it suited her. And one day she called me into this office. All my team around me knew what was going on, were really, really lovely and supportive. But she called me in the office and she said, you're stressed. And I was like, if you think I'm going to talk to you, why are you talking to me like that? what you do, you automatically withdraw. And as a result, I refused to open up and say what was going on in my life. And I said, she said, take time off. And I was like, no, I need to be in here because this was what was keeping me going. And I didn't tell her about my dad. I was like, I can't open up to you with this kind of attitude. So anyway, a few weeks later, my father passed away. I took one day off work because it was so stressful. That was all. And then I had the day off for his funeral. Went off to the funeral. Afterwards, I had a massive heart. Well, not massive. It was a heart attack. And I ended up in hospital. And she realized clearly, because she kept phoning me while I was in recess, and realized that probably her approach wasn't right. But that gave me that time afterwards to realize life doesn't have to be like this when you're a manager and leader. A little bit of compassion, a bit of empathy, a bit of listening makes all the difference. And I'm like, I don't want to be in an environment where you're treated like this. So I decided to start training for a professional consultancy and to set my own business up, because I just felt this wasn't the way that managers and leaders should lead. And that's not the way I'd ever led. And that was how I began my business.
Yes, so obviously a life-changing event. I'm sorry to hear about your father and also about the heart attack, actually. But a life-changing event gave you time to reflect, and then you changed what you were doing. So what jumped out at me just of that, when you were recounting what happened, was actually you said that everybody knew what was happening, but your manager didn't. Now, that to me is already a massive red flag, because if everyone else knows, how would you, because you'd have thought that's one thing your manager should definitely have been aware of, if they were having managing you correctly and having sensible conversations with you on a regular basis. So how did that occur, that you had such a big part of your life affecting your work and your manager knew nothing about it?
She was the kind of manager who would dip into your work if it was going wrong. If it was going right, she left you alone. It was one of these managers who never gave you feedback positive. It was only when it was wrong. And she definitely had favourites. But the thing was that every favourite, which was quite entertaining to watch in a way, but very sad at the same time, every favourite would be in favour for a while, and then they'd fall out of favour. And then the next person would come in. And looking back, I feel really sad that I didn't initially spot that, and that I saw other people going through the same thing, and I felt like I didn't actually give them enough support at the time. So it was a very big lesson to me. And I know that subsequently people who had not seen what was going on with me then realized what a toxic environment we were in.
Okay, so effectively she wasn't even doing the favourite thing is obviously a massive no-no in any management handbook or in practice. She wasn't actually really trying to understand the people who are working for, which I always find, the advice I always give to people whenever they want to go into management is, firstly, if you don't like working or developing, and I think developing people, go and do something else, because that's what it's about. You have to be interested in people. You have to be interested in what they're doing and what their lives are and how you can work with them and make their lives better, not just their working life, but just the whole overall person, because you can't disconnect your home life from, you know, you're one person. You can't just say, oh, well, I'm like this at home, but I'm like this at work.
And that's an interesting one, because when I do DISC assessments, if you've got somebody who's showing that they have different, perhaps, strengths, different stressors, then you will see if there's a disparity between work and home. And if they're not being their true selves at work, then eventually they're going to lead to burnout. And it's really something we need to be aware of. We should be able to be our authentic selves at work.
No, 100%. And just bridging between what you did in the past and how obviously successful you've been in your own business, you're obviously a top voice on LinkedIn. And a lot of people who listen to my podcast and watch the podcast are linked to me on LinkedIn. So how did that come about? How did you become a top voice?
Actually, by just posting regularly and also commenting on the AI articles. Now, when I comment, I'm very practical. I'm all about the practical approach. I know the theories, but what we all really need is that practical insight of how do we actually apply this to the workplace? And so I've been very much about adding my comments around that. This is how I would do it, especially with my operational lead background. So whilst it was also my worst time, it was also my best time because I loved operationally leading far more than any of the other roles that I did. And bear in mind, I did project leading for EU exit, which was probably my worst nightmare, I have to say, because it was very much a VUCA, you know, the volatile situation, not knowing what was coming to us at each point. Great learning, absolutely great learning. I'd never really understood around the volatile and the uncertainty bit in change until I was put in that situation. And that was a real life changing moment for me, because I really learned that you just worked with what you knew and you didn't worry about the bits you didn't know. You just had to go with the flow, basically.
Okay, so you weren't actually looking for recognition. It just happened because you were actually engaging on LinkedIn effectively, which is always the advice I think people always give. Yeah, okay, excellent. So in your view, I mean, we're talking about difficult conversations. What are the most significant risks to a business when a leader consistently avoids difficult conversations with their staff, with their partners, with their employees? I mean, obviously, you've just given a brilliant example there. You left. What's the, aside from people leaving, what's the other risks to the business?
Yeah, you're going to get clashes. And those clashes can erupt into really serious situations at times. And you can end up with a grievance, and a grievance takes an awful lot of time to deal with. You could end up with that person walking out. You could end up with employment tribunals. They're all kind of situations that all take a lot of time and effort as a major blow to the business. And you're going to have to invest time and effort and probably recruitment costs in the end to fill that place in. Also, if you don't deal with things on a lesser way, you're going to get performance issues. If you're not having those conversations around the performance you're seeing or the behaviour you're seeing, it just continues. Nothing changes. And it starts to percolate out to the team. They're noticing it and they get like unrestful, they're up in arms, and you'll see them around the water coolers. You might see more sick absence. You might see unexplained absence. And if you're not looking at any of those things, then you're missing out on a trick, because you should be looking at those statistics regularly and looking at what's going on around you. The best thing I ever did was I used to stay a bit later at night because it was a long journey and I just wanted to go when it was quieter. Because I used to go by train. So I used to sit in the corner and we had like cabinets down the middle, and they always used to forget I was there. And I would hear so many brilliant things that I'd know, oh, I've got a problem there. I need to deal with it. And just by listening, having your ear to the ground floor will make you pick up the issues that you actually need to deal with.
Yeah, interesting. I remember one of my managers that I had very early on in my career, who was brilliant, actually. He used to talk to me when I first went, because I was a salesperson, and I went into an office, and he was advising me on how you need to manage an office. And he talked about managing by walking about. And he said, management, he said, Akeem, is like a bank. He said, you have to keep putting money in, because then when you take it out, when you need to take it out, you've got something in there. So if you never put anything in, and you just want to keep taking out, you're not going to get anything, and you're going to be bankrupt.
Exactly.
And I thought that's a great analogy, actually. So I always had that in my mind whenever I've managed people, is that actually it's not about me just demanding things from the people I manage, but what am I putting back in? So I think those sort of things are quite clear, aren't they, in terms of all the costs, the time, the energy, the issues with your team, etc. If you don't manage it and then you don't have those difficult conversations. So why do you think
And you'll have seen it because this is your area and you work in lots of business where people are nervous about having difficult conversations. So why do you think that people and leaders are so reticent and nervous and scared in some cases to have those difficult conversations?
Quite often it's a fear of confrontation, a fear of how the person is going to react. That's one. And then I did a masterclass on Friday, and 59% of the people there said they had this fear about managing their emotions. So I think that's another one. And I think they're the two key areas, really. Some people also struggle with how to go in and start the conversation and how are they going to actually say it. And that's really easy to sort with training, because there is a structure you can use, and you can sort of get yourself prepared before you go in.
Yeah, no, I know certainly whenever I was having, to be honest, it's not even just when I was having a difficult conversation. Whenever I was having a one-to-one with any of my team, I would always take copious notes about what am I going to say. And I always think, well, if they say this, then I just need to have an idea and a framework of what I want to actually articulate, so it's clear. And we were talking just before we came on air, weren't we, about a lot of difficult conversations arise because there isn't any ground rules in the first place. And setting those ground rules can hopefully avoid some of those. So just on that point, and you'll have seen it, I'm sure. So people are nervous. You can then give them a framework to help them start to approach those. Culture is a massive, massive talking point now, because culture, as they say, strategy for breakfast, etc. So if you don't have those difficult conversations or you start trying to avoid them, what are sort of like some of the long-term effects on the culture of the business?
If we think culture is partly about the stories and the rituals, you know, which is a key part. Stories go under the surface and people repeat them and share them. Even years later, I can remember in our large organization getting stories told to me that were years later. And that influences what the culture is as a start. And so it can create toxicity. And also, I think what you often see is you see that it affects the culture by the very behaviours that are being exhibited. So if you're not having those difficult conversations and you've got some really awful behaviours going on, then you will see that percolates through that culture. People will think that's acceptable. And so if you don't have those conversations, you're allowing it to continue on. As well, it can quite often be senior leaders. I can remember having a senior leader who was actually bullying, but didn't even perceive that she was bullying. And it was interesting because we set up a workshop about bullying for the whole team. We got her in there. We gave her the ACAS definition of bullying, and the light bulb went on. She said, "Oh my goodness." And we said, even if it's once, it's still classed as bullying. And she hadn't realised that her behaviour was creating it in others and also affecting all of us. And it was really that she had very high demands, so high, you almost couldn't meet those expectations. So it's about setting your expectations as well at the right level and being also open if somebody fails to, okay, so what have we learned from it? And she wasn't like that at all. It was just, you were berated. You know, you've done this wrong. This isn't acceptable. I'm not happy. And then people are frightened to open up. So that's another part of what you'll see happen in culture when you're not having those conversations that are, as you talked about before we started, about, you know, being open to development and encouraging people. It's okay to make mistakes. Let's admit it. It's all right.
Yeah.
Let's learn from it, though. That's all I ask. And I had this thing in work as well, just thinking about it, where I'd go, no surprises. And as long as somebody told me, then I was fine, because you can sort it if you know. Whereas if it's under the carpet, again, that affects the culture. and affects your performance. So let's just be open and talk about how we can make things better.
It's interesting you talked about that particular instant where you're saying that she was bullying but didn't realise she was bullying. So how do you, because I think that's a really nice example that you actually just got the whole team in, so you weren't directing it at her, but you're still having that difficult conversation effectively. Because I've noticed lots of people, as you said, certainly at senior management level, think that having high standards necessitates berating people, and lots of people who are bullies, well, you know, if you see it in politics, you know, all those people who've been done for bullying, they say, well, I've got high standards and I've just told them, you know, what they need to be, and I'm a straight talker. So how do you get over that? Because although they see it as I'm just a straight talker and I've got high standards, the people that are subjected to it see it as bullying. So all the things you just talked about, toxicity, stifling, openness and honesty and integrity in the workplace are still going to happen, but the leader is still thinking, oh, I'm a great leader because I'm just open and honest and I tell it as it is. How do you overcome that sort of challenge with a leader?
So there's several ways. I think you either tell them straight, and I've had to do that. I had a manager who was micromanaging two of us. We were co-leads, and the other co-lead just couldn't hack it and asked to move. But didn't actually tell him what the issue was. So he came and he asked me if I was anything. He was open to having the feedback. And I said, well, actually, you're micromanaging us. But you can put it in such a way that they can't take umbrage. And my argument was, well, you've been at the same grade as us. You've now got promotion. You need to let go. You need to trust us to get on with what we're doing. And sometimes that could be one of the issues. So going back to your question, which I've forgotten.
Oh, right, yeah. No, it's just how do you challenge when you've got somebody who thinks they're a good leader, thinks that bullying behaviour is just setting high standards. How do you get that across to them?
So, yeah, so also I think it's about managing upwards, so setting the example of how you do it. So very much about compassion and empathy and showing them that is a way you can do it as well. So I've had situations where people have not wanted to do it the way that you've discussed. So if you manage upwards and show them how it can be done, sometimes they absorb it. But most of the time, it's just a conversation, and it's really difficult when it's your boss. But if you go in and keep it factual and give specific examples, then it's going to be an easier conversation. And if you don't get drawn into the emotional aspect as well.
So effectively what you're saying is being objective with examples rather than subjective. Because I think, when you start pointing at behavior, individual behaviors, that's, I think, probably when people start getting a bit defensive, as opposed to giving some objective examples of how it's going to affect or what's happening. So you mentioned earlier that you have kind of like a framework. I'm not expecting you to give us the whole framework, but can you give us some insight as to how and some strategies to try and deal with those difficult conversations?
This framework's out there anyway, and I go back to this one every time because I think it's one of the best. And another coach actually shared it with me, Jackie Jaguar, and she said to me how good it was, and she's right, it is. And it's called AID, A-I-D, action, state what the individual did, keep it to only one or two items. Don't go any more than that. Keep the emotion out of it. So be really specific about that feedback that you're giving them with what the action was. And then impact. So explain the impact of the behavior or the performance that you're seeing, whether it's positive or negative. And then D is either do or development. So guide them what they need to do in the future to get a good outcome. Now, the do bit, the development bit, is the bit I like, development, because I think it's about sitting down together and talking about how you can collaborate to move that person forward to improve things. So it's about listening to them. What are their suggestions? And sometimes it takes a bit of work, especially if they're not used to being able to open up and give their suggestions. But when you do it that way, you're collaborating and it's a win-win. So it's a really good way of doing it. And then make sure afterwards that you put it in writing, in an email with who's doing what actions, and then make sure you set a review meeting, because quite often people forget to do the review meeting.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good point, is about that documentation, isn't it? Because then, I mean, as we were talking about before, it's about setting the boundaries. But once you've set the boundaries, you need to make sure those boundaries are very clear to everybody, i.e. you follow it up in email, because you could have a conversation with somebody and then two people's memories of their conversation are very different.
Yeah.
So actually putting in an email, and then, as you said, having a review meeting and setting those review milestones almost, so that you can actually see that you're working together. And that's, you know, that's just good practice for any sort of development, really. And that's just any good management, is having good review meetings so people know where they are and where they're trying to get to. So I still wonder, because I think most people know about these sort of conflicts and the tensions and the issues that arise when you're avoiding it, but you still get. So if you've got an example of somebody who's, of where you've got someone who's a bit nervous about that conversation and you haven't in the first instance been able to convince them to have that difficult conversation, I'm just interested to know how you talk those sort of people around. Because I've seen almost two kinds of people in the workplace. You've got the belligerent ones who are very, oh, I know what I'm doing, you can't tell me anything, and I'm just being matter of fact. And then the second category are, I just don't really like having difficult conversations. I don't like conflicts. So I'm thinking more about that second category. How do you deal with those people?
Oh, an example I'd give there is, I was sick absence champion, would you believe it, for quite a few years. And it was an area where managers really kind of strayed away from not having, they wouldn't have the conversations. They really struggled with the fact that they would have somebody on long-term sick. And part of our process was that you needed to have a meeting with that person when they were on long-term sick. And for a very good reason, it was about supporting them back into the work environment and finding out what support and help they needed. But for some reason, they couldn't really feel comfortable with that. So quite frequently, I would actually coach them into having the conversations. So there were two ways I did it. I would either sit down with them and come up with a way that they could have the conversation and make sure they had a support in there who was doing the minutes, who they felt would give them that kind of reassurance and keep them feeling more safe. Or other times, I actually went in and did the meeting for them and took them in with me to show them how it should be done. And it was really very much about being kind, being compassionate, really listening to what the person was saying and what they weren't saying, which was really important, and working out what was going under the surface so that you could then provide them the support to get back in. And often it was as simple as doing things like saying, look, I know you must be really worrying about coming into the workplace and wondering what's gone on while you've been gone and all of this, but let's meet for a coffee before you go in and let me just give you a quick update so you know what's gone on, and then I'll walk in with you so you don't feel so bad. And it was getting the managers to see that just having that conversation and making it supportive was an easier conversation.
Yeah, no, and I think I suppose what you're saying there, it's about how you approach it and what is the outcome you're trying to achieve. Where yeah. I think a lot of people think that, oh, well, I've just got to go in. I'm not really sure how I'm going to approach it. And I'm not sure that they're going to like the person on the receiving end of the conversation is going to like where we're going. Whereas if your desire in that example is to actually give support, you know, how can anyone be upset with you trying to give them support and actually having a conversation with them and being interested in you know, them and their circumstances? So yeah, that leads me on to another question, which is, have you got examples of, or should I say, yeah, when you've had the conversation, does that change your relationship? Because obviously, you know, when you've got a difficult conversation to have, then the two people involved normally know there's a conversation that needs to be had, and one side or the other or both are avoiding it. So when you actually have it, you know, has that changed your relationship with that individual? Because that's obviously another reason why people are worried about having the conversation.
It can do. I think it's if you know your team member in the first place, and I always go back to when I talk about difficult conversations, really understand yourself and then understand your team member. So you understand their triggers, you understand what motivates them, what makes them tick. And then you understand what's going on in their life, like we've talked about earlier, then you really can have a decent conversation. And it's also about psychological safety, isn't it? So it's giving them the basis so that when you go and have to have those difficult conversations, you're not making it so that that relationship's going to fail, because all you're doing is carrying on those kind of compassionate. And I keep going back to compassion and empathy, but if you are exhibiting those and doing it genuinely, they will pick up on that and your relationship will be fine. If you're not, then you may well ruin that relationship, and that's why you need to get it right. And it's we all get it wrong at times. I've had cases where I've absolutely got it wrong, but learn from it. That's all I say. And one of the things I do on my training is we look at a review structure for you to go away and look at, you know, what happened, how did it go, what could have been even better, because I'm very much about being quite positive about all of this, and just realizing that we all get things wrong. We all say the wrong thing at the wrong time, but just learn from it, and it will stick with you more if it's gone wrong than if it's gone right. Really, it's weird, isn't it? And I remember I went into some training, and we actually had actors come in and do the person, and the first one I went on was brilliant. I was like, yeah, I can do this. I can go, and I can do this with my team. And then the next one, oh my goodness! I went, how am I going to do a conversation with my team? And actually, I then had to go back and do a conversation with a team member who was completely unreceptive to any type of coaching, who had performance behavior issues, and who I was really struggling with. And there are times when the approach that you want to take is not the right approach, and you've got to be really direct and just tell them straight, if this doesn't change, then we are going down the lines of warnings around your performance, and I want to support you and I want to get you there to keep you here and to help you do well in the workplace. But if you're not going to work with me, I can't do anything. And sometimes you have to say those conversations, and that was one case. And most of the time, people are quick to want to change things. And often something's happening in the background you're not even aware of, and they're not doing anything deliberately. It's just something that's going on in their lives. And if you have those conversations, you find out.
Yeah, I think it's, I've not seen anybody in my working experience that doesn't want to do a good job. They may not be doing a good job, but people want to do a good job, and they want to be told how to do the good job and developed into a person who can do a good job. So I think you're right. It comes back to that. What's your motivation? And are you trying to get to a positive place, or are you just trying, as we talked about a bit earlier, or are you just trying to bully somebody because I need to be strong and I need to be firm and I need to just tell them it's not acceptable? And I think that if you're thinking about, as they say, start with the end in mind, and the end in mind is to actually get that person better, then right. I think that always that reflects in the conversations that you're having. So in terms of, I mean, you're talking about learning there. So can you give me, one thing that you've learnt that you say, yeah, this is one thing that I think you should, that you always do, or someone should always do, and then one thing that you think that you've learnt that you thought, I'm not going to do that again then?
I think always prepare, as you said yourself. So I have like a template I use so that I don't miss out on anything. Even to thinking about before you go in, what emotions are you feeling at the moment? Are you in the right place to have that conversation? If not, what can you do to change your emotion? And there are techniques that you can use to diffuse the emotion that you're feeling. If you're angry, please do not go in, because it just simply will backfire. And then the things that I've done in the past that I've got wrong is as simple as going in and starting the conversation in the wrong way. So I think it's really thinking about how you're going to open that conversation to make the person feel like you're really there to just support and get them to open up, and so that they can feel, okay, I can open up here. And certainly don't do what my manager did to me. You're stressed, because it just makes you defensive. So, yeah.
Have you got any tips on good openings to those sorts of meetings, or does it just depend on what the situation is?
It really depends on the situation. And certainly in my training, I do give a list of opening lines that are potentially there. But it's, again, just think about how you would feel. Stand in the other person's shoes and think, try and look at it from their perspective. And so the key thing here is don't go in judgmental. Go in thinking you're not really sure what's been going on and you want to find out. Because quite often we can be quite judgmental in our heads, and it's natural. Yeah. It's the way our brain works. But you have to kind of stop yourself and say, okay, this is what I think I'm seeing, but is that really right? I need to find out and ask the questions. So just, you know, and just say, thank them for the time. Thank you for giving me your time to come into this conversation. It's really brilliant. I really want to kind of just have a general discussion around what's going on and how I can support you. If you start in a compassionate way, people are more likely to open up.
Excellent advice. And one other thing I've seen a few times in when you're having a difficult conversation is somebody starts crying. What would your advice be on that? Because obviously that can be quite disconcerting for both parties, actually.
Okay, so just give them time, and they're probably going to feel very embarrassed and very silly. So just reassure them that it's fine. It's fine to feel like that. So just telling them that and giving them a few moments to regain their composure is, you know, a good thing to do. But certainly don't make them feel bad because they're crying. Don't tell them that they're silly and, well, you're making a song and dance over nothing. I've seen that happen, and what that just diminishes the way the person sees you then anyway. So just show that compassion, I think.
Okay, that's very good advice. I know certainly men find it very uncomfortable when someone starts crying in their presence. I'm hoping that's changing, but you know, men who like to believe that, oh well, I'm strong and I'm this and that. And it's not just women that cry, because people will be thinking, oh, well, it's a man boss and it's a woman crying. No, it can be the complete reverse. It can be two people, a woman, a man. And, you know, it doesn't make any difference. I've seen all circumstances, because, as you said, it just depends what's going on in that person's life and how emotional they are. So it is useful to understand how, and I think what you've said there is exactly it. It's having that emotional intelligence to not make somebody feel bad about it, because I'd be surprised if you've got people who have never cried. Different circumstances, of course. You might have people who've never cried in a workplace, but everybody has emotions which will bring them to tears in certain circumstances. And I think you need to bear that in mind before you actually start having that conversation, and giving them time, I think, is the perfect.
If they're really almost hysterical, suggest they go and get a drink, and change the location. Even shall we just go for a walk around the block to give you time to, you know, feel better? I know this is really hard, but we could do that. Or should we go and get a coffee over there, or something that changes the dynamics? Even if you're struggling with your emotions, sometimes you're both sitting, just say, I'm just got to stand for a minute, just make some reason. And just changing almost diffuses what's going on as well. So anything like that. I've recently been studying positive intelligence, which I'm really fascinated by. And one of the key things it's taught me is, and I wish I'd known this years ago, is to I do breathing for 30 seconds, just concentrating on my breathing, breathing deeply. But I label it as I'm doing it in my head. I'm going breathing, breathing. It's a really simple thing. But because you're homing in on your breathing, no other thoughts are coming in. Or if they do, they only come in momentarily and go out again. So you're actually starting to regulate your emotions. And I find that really works for me.
Excellent. That's really, really powerful advice, actually. And I was just thinking about what you were saying about, because that's all about changing your state, isn't it, really? And even the standing or going for a walk is about trying to change the state and change the energy flow of the conversation. So it just popped into my head as you were talking about that. So how do you do that when you're in this sort of environment? Because obviously there's now a plethora of video calls. So if you're going to have that difficult conversation and you're in a kind of a remote working situation, what would your advice be for that sort of situation?
So it's a really difficult one, isn't it? And actually, I have a blog out that says I actually don't recommend doing them virtually, but if you have to, then make sure the person is on their own. Check that they're in a position where you can have that conversation in the first place. They're not going to be interrupted. And then again, if you can feel that they're struggling a bit and they need some time, just say to them, do you want 5 minutes to go and get a drink? Stop the call, say, come back in 5 minutes and we'll carry on. That 5 minutes where they've gone and got a drink will probably diffuse them enough that they'll be able to carry on. And they'll be grateful that you did that and you noticed. And I think a lot of the time we don't really watch people on Zoom or Teams. And I think you can often see little nuances going on and you need to be aware of them. And I've been in conversations where I've seen people go, just flinch a little bit when you said something. Like, they didn't like that. What didn't they like about that? So that gives you an opportunity to have a conversation around, okay, were you all right with what I said? It's that inquiry, isn't it? And it's, we don't do enough of it, let's be honest.
And I think it's a really interesting point, because I've always been interested in body language, and I'm a real student of human nature and picking up cues. My kids hate it because I can read them like a book, to be honest, because I can always get an idea of, actually, that's not true, or that is true, or you're not fit, you feel like this. So even when I'm on a call, and maybe it's just a way for me to keep interested when you're on a video call sometimes, even if there's quite a few people, and I'm always looking at people's faces and people's body language, and often you will pick something up, I'll say it on the call or I'll ring them afterwards and say, I noticed that when I was talking about X, Y, and Z, you didn't look very happy, but, you know, is there an issue? And I think you're right. On video calls, people are less attentive to people's emotional state than when they're in face to face, because it's a lot harder to ignore somebody's emotional state when you're sitting opposite them. So I think that's really good advice, actually, in terms of keeping an eye on
And it's interesting, isn't it, as well, because we used to do Teams meetings without the camera on. No idea why we did, but it was common for that to happen. And so you would have to really listen to the tone of the voice, but you could always pick up if somebody wasn't quite right. And you just put a little message, I'm going to ring you afterwards, just want to catch up. Because then, as you say, people will often open up when you do that. One of my most embarrassing moments was we had some grief training as managers via Teams. All the cameras were off, thank goodness. But I just lost my brother, and they were talking about how managers should react and behave when somebody was going through grief and what the kind of conversations you have. And my manager hadn't done any of that. And I'm afraid it spilt out into that meeting. And I burst into tears and said, well, I could have done with that, but I never got it. And I felt awful afterwards because I hadn't actually told him. But everybody afterwards actually messaged me to say, look, we're really sorry. We didn't realise you were going through this, Nicola. And so in one way, it made people realise, but I was still embarrassed. And that's exactly it. When you cry and you're feeling embarrassed, you don't want somebody saying you shouldn't have done that or that was the wrong thing to do. You want somebody to say, okay, we understand. How can we support you?
And I think that's the key, isn't it? Because your emotions, you don't get emotional in any, whether that's anger or crying or whatever it may be. You're not doing it because you're trying to be difficult. You're doing it, that's your emotion at the time.
That's right.
So it's about managing those emotions. And actually, if you're a boss or a manager, you're trying to support those people's emotions to get them into a better state for the work, obviously, but more importantly, for themselves. Because if you're focusing on the person first, the work will follow, I always find, rather than just thinking, oh, I've got to focus on the tasks. You didn't do that well, did you? Or you didn't do that well. There's probably a reason why they didn't do that well. And you need to get to the nub of that before you can start actually then get moving on with the actual task issue. So just on that note, because I'm always trying to find examples, and I know that you're practical. But so if you've got examples of conversations that you've had that then, because we talked earlier about culture and changing the culture and actually then that leading to a better environment for everybody. So if you've got examples, a couple of examples or one example of where you'd say, yeah, this is a really good example of, we had a challenge, there was a difficult conversation that we had, someone was avoiding it, I then worked with them to actually have that conversation, and that then may actually change the culture or the individuals.
Actually, well, the one that springs out to my mind is I had a very new manager who didn't particularly like having conversations, and we were actually going to change the helpline rotor. So it wasn't just one conversation, it was a conversation with the team. And we were going to change it because the way we had the rotor wasn't working. And she was really, really nervous, but she asked me to go into the meeting with her. And we'd had a conversation beforehand about how to have the conversation. And I went in and she did it brilliantly. And all the team asked questions, but none of them opposed it. And they were known for being quite rebellious at times. So she handled it really well. And it was great to see her as a new manager stepping up and feeling confident enough to have that conversation. And you know, I'd went in thinking I might have to support her and I didn't have to do a thing. I was just there. And so it gave me a glow to know that having that conversation beforehand and preparing had really helped. Sometimes it's just having that conversation about how to have that conversation kind of really gives that person the confidence to know what to do then. And then you can leave them to fly.
Yeah, and I think that, and I wrote that down as one of the key things, is about that preparation when you are asking your advice on, you know, one thing. And I think that there's very few things I can think of in business that get worse the more you prepare. Because, you know,
yeah,
and lots of people, you can see that there's lots of people who go into those conversations and they're not really prepared and they're winging it and it's a disaster. And you're thinking, well, you could have probably worked it out, it's going to be a disaster, because the fact it's a difficult conversation means there's lots of emotions on both sides. So not to prepare would seem negligent to me, to be honest, you really need to be focusing, because you're trying to get to, you're trying to change hopefully someone's state, but also you're trying to get to a real positive outcome. And it can have, as you said in that example, a real positive impact on a whole group of people, which then affects the culture, depending on how you approach it. Because you could have quite easily gone in there and then she was like, well, this is what's going to happen. That's it, without preparing. And this team, as you've just said, normally quite a contentious team, would have been asking loads of questions. As a new manager, because I know I've been there, I've had some disastrous conversations when I was a new manager. And you think you know what you're doing, or you're just copying somebody else's style as opposed to being yourself. And it still keeps me awake at night, even though it's 20 years ago. You think, oh my God, why did I say that? But that's because I didn't prepare for it. You know, I went in. And you just thought, okay, well, I'm quite good at talking, so I'll be all right. And I've seen other people do it, so I know what I'm going to say. And then they say something that you didn't, that you weren't expecting. Then someone else says something. And before you know it, you're drowning under an avalanche. So I think, preparation is a really...
I've got a good story there of we were really behind with dealing with post. And so I took my managers out to do a bit of a problem solve. And I had this idea that I wanted to do, which was, and I'd seen it work really well in other places, where you dealt with the post that was coming in on the day, and then you had some people working on the back end, and then eventually they meet in the middle and all the post is up to date. Okay, so it's all answered, all sorted. But I had one manager who decided she didn't like that approach. It wasn't right, the right customer service. And I totally got where she was coming from, but we had no other possible solution to how we were going to resolve the fact that we were so behind with our posts. So it was one of those difficult conversations where I had to say, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to give it a go. We'll give it a go. If it doesn't work, we'll stop. And, you know, then we'll come up with something else. And unless you can come up with something now, which none of them could. But it got really heated. She wound the rest of the team up and we all ended up at loggerheads. And my kind of just left it at that. We all walked away and we weren't a good... Even years later, I still look at it and I think, oh, I could have handled that so differently. One, I hadn't prepared. Two, I didn't think to stop the conversation. Right, look, let's take this offline. Let's have this conversation separately because we just need to move this forward right now. But let's have that conversation. And it wasn't until I spoke to my manager afterwards and she said, well, all you needed to say was, I'll talk to you offline. I went, oh, I never thought of that because we were in the heat of the moment. And it's funny, isn't it?
It is, and I think what you've just identified there, it's about, and actually went in the AID, because that objectifies it rather than subjectifies it. It's about trying to take the emotion out of it. Because I think once emotions get involved, it's very easy to become irrational, and then you see the red mist descends, and oh, they're attacking me, and then therefore, it doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter how rational you're being, you put them into a state where they're no longer listening. They're just wanting to get a specific point across. Where, as you said, if you just say, well, actually, okay, let's take it offline, or okay, yeah, get your point, but let's speak about this later, etc. I think you just try to diffuse the situation and actually get the other person, and also for yourself to understand, actually, no, what I'm trying to do is not win an argument. What we're trying to do is resolve a situation so that everybody's happy, because that's how you then lead to, you know, that cultural shift and a better performance. Because, you know, again, I wrote down all the things you said, that the risk to the business about clashes, grievance, people leaving, employment tribunal, you know, all that list is management time. So if you're doing that, you're not actually doing what you should be doing. If you're doing that, then the team is not performing at the optimal level. So there's a massive rationale, even if you aren't interested in people, even if you're not interested in actually people being happy in your business, just managing difficult conversations makes business sense, actually.
Absolutely. And I'll end with this, because 874,000 employees are estimated to take sick absence each year as a result of conflict, at an estimated cost to the organisations of 2.2 billion. GitNux.org is the where these statistics come from. And then adding to this, in the UK, an average of 485,800 employees resign each year as a result of work conflicts. So even if some of those ones that are resigning were also off sick first, you're still talking about 1 million employees probably a year who are struggling with conflict and because the conversations aren't being had.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I think that is a perfect place to sort of end, because I've got one more question. You might answer, you might not, but that is a perfect place, because it's about, it makes one, in fact, I had a podcast, I've forgotten the chap's name now, which I feel very bad about, but I had a podcast a bit ago, and the podcast was called, basically, Looking After Sick People Makes You Money. Effectively, is what we were, that's what we were talking about. He didn't show me any stats, because he's actually from Holland, so he had lots of global stats. But this is really interesting, because it shows that if you don't deal with it, then you're going to be falling into that category. And £2.2 billion—it's a lot of money to lose just because you've decided not to have a difficult conversation. So it just makes sense. So yeah, the only question I was going to ask, and this is, I'll end on this one, is I always try and find something topical that's in the news. There's not always something topical in the news. And I've noticed that Liz Truss's book is out at the moment. And interesting enough, I'm not going to name names, but because of some of the work I do, I speak to some government ministers, and there's a government minister or his relationship manager was telling me about Liz Truss and said that Liz Truss is known for being one of those people that is very direct, but actually a bit of a bully, and that she has a massive issue with people leaving. And obviously we've all seen her on the TV, etc. So if you were a fly on the wall, and I'll just give you an example, allegedly, I can only say allegedly because I was in the room, she went up to someone and tapped him on the head and said, "Are you listening? You're not getting it, are you? What would your advice to somebody like that who thinks that's a great way of managing because they're being direct and I'm very demanding?"
Respectfully remind them that constitutes bullying, and that I was going to consider doing a grievance, or even I think we need to have a discussion around this, because quite honestly, that is atrocious behaviour and simply is not acceptable. And everybody deserves to be treated compassionately, with empathy, with kindness, and to be listened to, and to ask their views. Now, there are times when you're going to have to say, "Look, I don't think you're getting what I'm saying. If you're not getting what I'm saying, you've actually got to look at yourself, because there's an issue there. Yeah. It's not them, it's you. And so you need to find another way of getting that message across." So I'm sorry, but I would wait, and then I would have a quiet word with her and tell her straight that, you know, if she's got that direct approach, then she can take it. But most of them can't, usually, when they've got a direct approach.
Yes.
So I think I'd say, you know, this isn't acceptable, and if you persist in this kind of behaviour with me, then I will do a grievance.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a perfect way to end, because I think what came out of that was really that compassion and thinking about the individual and understanding what you're trying to achieve. And the best way to achieve it is probably not knocking on the side of the head.
What would you do?
Bullying.
What would you do?
Exactly what, pretty much what you said. I mean, I think depending on my age and what stage of my journey of that. When I was younger, I'd have probably grabbed the hand and actually held it and said, "I don't think that's acceptable." Now I would have probably just moved away so she couldn't tap me on the head, and then I said, "Look, I don't think that's right." And then I said, "Can I speak to you afterwards?" But I would have definitely had a conversation. There's no way that I could have somebody doing that in a public arena and not do anything about it. I mean,
in fact, right.
So yeah, because I think, you know, when I was told about it, I just thought, and the reason why I mentioned it, because I was just been listening to Liz Truss on a program talking about a book, and she was saying, "Oh yeah, well, I'm very direct and I'm very demanding." So you could see in her mind that her aim of being demanding justified any action, effectively, in her mind, whereas it doesn't to me.
No.
And when the relationship manager in the government told me about it, I just thought, "Bloody hell, this is, I mean, I don't even know if it's assault."
I think it would be classed as assault.
Yeah, and it just seems so unacceptable to me. But there seems to have been almost like a culture, when we're talking about culture again, there seems to be a culture of that sort of thing, because, you know, Dominic Raab's another one, and there's a whole raft of them who've been done for bullying, and every single one of them's defence is, no, I like robust debate, and then he's throwing things across the table at people. And you're like, "Where?" Sometimes I just think, well, how are you brought up? Because I just don't understand how you go into a workplace and all of a sudden you're now throwing things at people, knocking people on the head, shouting at people in the face, and you think that that's an acceptable way to communicate with people, especially when you are communicating with somebody because you're wanting them to improve their performance. And you think, "Oh, I know, let me terrify them and bully them. That will improve their performance." I'm not sure that ever happened. I don't think it's ever happened.
And it definitely doesn't. And I can remember very, very much at the start of my career, I had a manager who would shout at us if we didn't get things right. But in the end, I got so sick of it, I actually told him what I thought. And he stopped. He wasn't actually a people manager. He should never have been in management. And he was really good at what he did technical, but he was not good as a manager. And eventually got moved. But that was because I was equal opportunities and diversity rep. And I kept going in to, and saying, you need to do something. He didn't do it again. He didn't do it intentionally. He thought he was just getting the best performance, but it wasn't acceptable.
I think that's a perfect place in where to end. You know, it's not acceptable to treat people without compassion, without understanding their own emotions. And if you do that and you go into every conversation like that, then not saying that there's not going to be difficult conversations, but they will be made a lot easier. So, Nicola Richardson, thank you very, very much for coming on. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it, Hakeem. I've really, really had a lovely time talking to you. You made me think of lots of memories as well, so that was quite funny.
So if you didn't understand the importance of dealing with difficult conversations before you listen to this podcast episode, I'm hoping that has changed after my conversation with Nicola, because just as she said at the end there, if you just take into account the number of people who go on sick because of conflict and the amount of money, 2.2 billion she mentioned, that are actually outside of business, or you lose in business because of people leaving or being sick because of conflict, then that alone should be enough to convince you that this is a really important topic that you have to take seriously. So if you're a leader, really listen back to this episode and make sure you take that into consideration. And the thing that I really liked was that when Nicola talks about, it's all about preparation, these difficult conversations. And if you actually, you know, prepare for those meetings and use the AID framework, if you remember that, action, and then impact on behavior, and then D for do or development, that will make those conversations much easier, and those conversations will then impact your culture and, more importantly, your bottom line. So hope you enjoyed what you've just listened to. And if you want to pick up the show notes, head over to the salesacceleration.com/podcast-show-notes, and you'll be able to subscribe to our mailing list and get show notes for every single episode. And as always, subscribe, like, and share with your friends, colleagues, and anyone else who you think may be interested. But most of all, keep the feedback coming so that we can continue to improve and give you more of what you like. Hope you enjoyed this as much as I did, and as I always do, keep listening and keep growing.